can ask him ourselves. Are you there, Stephen?
I am. Hello, Phil.
Hello. It's great to be talking to you. You have an article at What's Left, and I'll tell people, gowans.wordpress.com. It was published February the 9th. It couldn't have been more timely. What U.S. Congress researchers reveal about Washington's designs on Syria, with the subtitle, Seeing the Government in Damascus as Too Far to the Left, Washington has been trying to orchestrate regime change in Syria since at least 2003, and it's all based on really quite an interesting place. It's called the Congressional Research Service. Well, we hear that. It was a demonstration, a nice, peaceful, democratic wish by the people of one little town or city in Syria, and that the Syrian awful government repressed them, and therefore they were turned into a popular uprising, and the U.S. announced that President Assad has to step down. So, but you say that's really not the case. What have you found?
Yeah, what I found by looking at, well, as you mentioned, the U.S. Congress employs researchers to prepare background documents for members of Congress on various subjects. And these papers provide a good overview of the thinking in Washington about various matters of foreign policy. And so I've been looking at the papers written on Syria, especially the ones written before the uprising in 2011, to see what light they shed on what U.S. thinking and policy was prior to the uprising and, you know, how it may have shaped these developments. And when you look at these documents going back to 2005, what you discover is that the United States was actively weighing regime change as early as 2003, and probably before that as well. And the favored approach at the time was through military intervention or an invasion. But it turned out that events conspired against that, and they had to go to their plan B. But what was interesting is that the papers point out that the reasons for regime change, and it was clear in 2003 that there was this consensus in Washington that there had to be a change in the policy framework in Damascus. But the researchers point out that the reasons for changing the regime had nothing to do with democracy promotion, because they pointed out quite explicitly that U.S. policy in the Middle East preferred secular dictatorships and monarchies.
Mm-hmm.
And they said the reason, and they were quite open about it, the reason why the United States wanted to change the regime in Damascus was they wanted to sweep away an impediment to U.S. goals in the region. And those U.S. goals are enumerated as to weaken opposition to Israel, because Syria, or the government of Syria under Assad and his father as well, is opposed to Syria and is officially at war with Syria. The second goal is to consolidate domination of Iraq. And what Washington was aggrieved about was that the Syrian government was opposed to Washington's aggression against Iraq. And they also wanted to create a free enterprise, free market economy within Syria. And there are these bitter complaints about how the Syrian government continued to follow what the researchers called the Soviet models.
Mm-hmm.
They had a largely publicly owned economy where the bulk of the workforce is employed in the public sector.
Yeah, I think the figure they gave was 70%.
Yes. 73%.
Mm-hmm.
And so effectively what they're saying is that they wanted the government in Damascus to submit to Israel's regional hegemony. They wanted it to submit to Wall Street's economic hegemony. And they wanted the government in Syria to accept the international dictatorship of the United States.
Mm-hmm. I struck by when I first read that was it seems to be exactly what I remember Syria saying. There was a thing called the Resistance Front, of which Syria was a member.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that they were not going to be agreeing to the various compromises and the various attempts to get the Arab states go along with recognition of Israel without taking up the question of Palestinians' return, Palestinians of the West Bank, occupation of the Golan Heights. And it was called the Resistance Front. And apparently what you speaking of this Congressional Research Service said that is exactly right.
Yes,
it is what the problem was, or is, I guess.
Yes, it's exactly right. And the plan, it appears, the plan was first to threaten Syria with the invasion of Iraq and to say essentially, if you don't go along, this is the same thing's going to happen to you. So the U.S. Secretary of State went to Damascus personally, and he said, you stop support for Hamas, you stop support for Hezbollah, and if you don't, what happened to Iraq is going to happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
As it turned out, the Pentagon soon discovered that the task of imposing, you know, the occupation on Iraq was just too costly and consumed far too many resources, especially because they're in Afghanistan at the time. And that they really couldn't afford to invade Syria. So that plan was never carried through on. But they did develop a plan B. And the plan B is interesting. So the plan B first involved sanctions. That was the first plank of plan B. And the sanctions were implemented through something called the Syria Accountability Act, which was signed in 2003. And it banned all U.S. exports to Syria except for food and medicine. So first, there's this attempt to, you know, create economic hardship within the country. But second, perhaps the more important plank of Plan B was to collude with the Islamist opposition in Syria to overthrow the government. And these documents, written in 2005, acknowledge that the principal opposition to the secular Syrian government was Islamic fundamentalists and had been for decades. And so there was an act called the Foreign Appropriations Act, which was signed into law. And what it did was it established unspecified sums to support the Syrian opposition. So most of this funding was going to a group called the National Salvation Front, which included the Muslim Brotherhood, which for decades had been committed to the violent overthrow of the secular government in Syria. And I should also, you know, underline the fact that the United States recognized that the main opposition to the secular government were Islamic fundamentalists and not secular, liberal, or social democrats, which is what some people seem to believe these days. But it's always been Islamic fundamentalists. So this funding was going to the National Salvation Front, or the Muslim Brotherhood, essentially. And leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood were invited to the White House on at least two occasions in 2006, according to Time magazine. So Washington had decided that it was going to collude with Islamists to overthrow the government in Damascus. And this long before the 2011 uprising.
Yes, and by the way, of course, that label is Appropriations Act, which means you're giving them money.
Yes. And they said,
go and buy something interesting with this money.
There was a minimum specified. This is interesting. In this legislation, it said they will receive a minimum of X million dollars, plus there's other unspecified funds.
Yeah.
So it's unclear. Just
we invite you to speculate. by the way, you also listed they had the Patriot Act, and the patriotism involved severing connections with Syrian banks.
Yes.
How is that patriotic? Whose patriotism is involved?
Yeah, it's another one of the, you know, the measures of economic warfare that the United States has been using in the last few decades, is trying to isolate countries financially or isolate their banking systems.
Now, by the way, part of what you're writing about, Stephen, you point out that they have a plan. And I wonder if you're watching, of course, and reading the headlines today about this, it was to hollow out Syria in a sense, right? To take they don't ever name, at least in the articles I've seen, the Ba'ath party, but they say President Assad and his whatever it is, political entity, but leave the army and the police with a new political leadership. That was the idea, right?
Yeah. And you can see these concerns also going all the way back to 2003 and recognizing that if there was going to be an alternative to Assad, it was going to be Islamic fundamentalists. And Washington didn't want Islamic fundamentalists coming to power in Damascus. And so there's always been this concern about, well, if we fund the opposition, we don't want to fund them too much because we don't want to actually have them come to power. We'd like them to force Assad to step down. Mm-hmm. And, the funding to the so-called rebels these days it follows along the same kind of strategy, which is to use military pressure to try to create a so-called political solution to the conflict. That's something that Assad has been complaining about, saying, well, everyone talks about a political solution, but what they don't acknowledge is that running alongside the political solution is this military solution. In fact, the political solution is based on a military solution, which is essentially weakening the Syrian army until Assad is in the position in which he has no choice but to step down. At least that was the hope prior to the intervention of Russia.
Yeah, and to go back to your original point, when they say a political solution, they mean ones that will toe the line for those points laid down explicitly by Colin Powell, right? When he met with them and said, you have to get rid of the Palestinians. You can't support Hezbollah. Could you, by the way, what is it about Hezbollah they don't like? What was it that they, why are they so focused on Hezbollah?
Well, the ostensible reason is because Hezbollah is terrorist. Mm-hmm. That's the reason they offer. But, of course, the real reason is because Hezbollah.
They are members of the Lebanese government, by the way.
Well, I think the real reason is because the principal obstacle to Israeli expansion into Lebanon and a principal obstacle to Israel trying to establish a government in Lebanon, which is essentially a puppet of Tel Aviv.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We've been watching it. If you were to kind of do a map and watch how it's been changing, people forget that Israel invaded Lebanon, and they intended to stay for as long as they could, but then the people of Lebanon, with Hezbollah leadership, moved them out. There was a time when the security of Lebanon was provided by Syria. Very few people refer back to that, but it was not that many years ago. It was Syria that was in Lebanon as the guarantor of the security and the stability of Lebanon. Something, I guess, that Colin Powell didn't like.
No, and that was one of his demands, was that Syria withdraw from Lebanon, which it did.
Now, you also bring up something that I've thought was really very helpful. That is that you say that I think it was Bush Sr., started this thing of watering down the definition of weapons of mass destruction for their own reasons. That's very enlightening. Could you expand on that, please?
Yeah, I mean, the original meaning of weapons of mass destruction was, well, it originally referred to nuclear weapons or future weapons of equal or greater destructiveness. But Bush needed a pretext for aggression against Iraq, so he redefined weapons of mass destruction to include weapons that Iraq had. And the weapons of focus became Iraq's chemical weapons.
Mm-hmm.
Now, chemical weapons, although they're now regarded as weapons of mass destruction because that's what they're always called, but when you look at their destructiveness relative to legitimate weapons of mass destruction, i.e. nuclear weapons, you see that they're not in the same category at all. In World War I, it took 70,000 tons of gas to produce as many fatalities as were produced by a single atom bomb at Hiroshima. Mm-hmm. And then when we consider that contemporary nuclear weapons have far more destructive potential than the atom bomb that was used at Hiroshima, suggesting that chemical weapons are in the same category as nuclear weapons is just completely absurd. Mm-hmm. But so it was in 1989 that Bush went to the UN, and he pledged to eliminate U.S. chemical weapons within 10 years, so by 1999. 27 years after he made that pledge, the Pentagon continues to have the world's largest chemical weapons arsenal, and will probably continue to have it for quite some time. But it's also interesting to note that in 2003, Syria proposed to the United Nations Security Council to make the Middle East a chemical weapons-free zone, and Washington blocked the resolution. And it blocked the resolution because Israel has chemical weapons, and it didn't want Israel to have to relinquish its chemical weapons, although we recall that Washington certainly pressed Syria to relinquish its chemical weapons.
Yeah, it almost went to war over it.
Then, you know, also numerous calls have been made to declare the Middle East a nuclear weapons-free zone. All of those calls have been blocked by the United States. Mm-hmm. So one of the ostensible goals of the United States for the Middle East is to reduce weapons or nuclear weapons or WMD proliferation. But that's, you know, completely insincere. Since the United States has certainly stood in the way of any effort to actually free the region of chemical weapons and nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And concerning weapons of mass destruction, back in 2003, it appears as if the plan of the U.S. government was to accuse Syria of having a wide-ranging WMD program to provide a pretext for an invasion of Syria. So the same pretext they used in Iraq. So we had John Bolton, who was, I think, he was one of Bush's velociraptors. I think he was undersecretary of, I don't know, non-proliferation or something. Mm-hmm. Who was accusing Syria of having a nuclear weapons program and a biological weapons program. Mm-hmm. And they had chemical weapons, but if you look at the Congressional Research Service documents, they acknowledge these accusations, but then they also cite reports from the CIA that essentially that the CIA had absolutely no evidence that Syria had a nuclear weapons program, and it doesn't, mm-hmm. or that it has a biological weapons program, but they had concerns that maybe they had aspirations to have one.
Yes. Well, by the way, and you remind everybody that we in order to listen to this without laughing out loud, you have to accept that we're dealing with a U.S. government that regards itself as exceptional, so it can talk about everybody else's weapons while they themselves have 10 times as many of each, biological, chemical, nuclear. And they can say, I think you might have something of this sort, without any equality, that where the state can say, I need that to defend myself. That you're not allowed to use that argument.
No, and this is happening. I mean, today in North Korea, where even people on the left are saying, well, you know, North Korea should relinquish its nuclear weapons and arrive at some kind of arrangement with the United States. But no one would ever suggest that maybe the United States should relinquish its nuclear weapons. Why is it that the United States gets to have arsenals of weapons of mass destruction and every other country that it doesn't like, that doesn't submit to its dictatorship, has to relinquish them, mm-hmm. or is not permitted to develop them?
Yes, and I learned from you something I'd like to ask you to repeat. Who is the commanding general of the South Korean army?
Yeah, in wartime, the command of the South Korean forces is under the United States.
Automatic.
Yeah.
So North Korea's answer is, I have a nuclear neighbor. that has 10 times as many weapons and 10 times as many missiles as I've got.
And is also under the U.S. nuclear umbrella. I mean, North Korea is not under anyone's nuclear umbrella except its own.
Yes, it's got its own umbrellas. It's and the last thing I want to make sure we touch on, and by the way, this is Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com, a terrific article on Syria and the real plan to remove the government, which was concocted years and years ago. Wall Street is a war street, I think we could say. You point out that the personnel making up the decision makers of America are indeed Wall Street people. Could you talk about that?
They are. It's interesting, if you take a look at the Obama administration, that almost every member of the administration, past and present, belongs to the Council on Foreign Relations, which is completely dominated by Wall Street. It's dominated by Wall Street money. And if they're not members of the on top of being members of the Council on Foreign Relations, many have spent part of their careers on Wall Street, or certainly have extensive connections to Wall Street.
Yeah, so it's not a regional outfit, and it's not a, you know, the, what democracy in its weirdness chose. There's a distinct crowd of people running U.S. policy.
Yes, yes. And it's just astonishing when you look at all of these cabinet positions in the United States with connections to Wall Street. And this, not only in the Obama administration, but this goes back, I mean, administration after administration.
And many of those personalities are absolutely interchangeable as well, right? They're in one administration, and 2 years later, they're in the other one.
Yes. Yes, exactly. We see that happening quite frequently. Yeah. Yes.
Well, Stephen Gowans, it's great talking to you. It's a terrific article, and I know you're going to be watching what's supposedly going to be a peace agreement, and with what you've told us as a backdrop, we better watch very, very closely. Thank you very, very much. We hope to talk to you again about this matter.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Bye. Bye-bye. That's Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com.